Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It's not a separate tap, you know, it's the same tap you do your washing up from, and it has the ability to produce boiling hot water, filtered water, and sparkling water. It's truly amazing. Go to cooker.co.uk to have a look at them. Cooker, spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. If you can be bothered, also, please give me some feedback on these podcasts. It honestly means the world to me to know people are enjoying listening to them. You know, as you know, I don't just go for the biggest names. I go for people that I think you and me will find interesting, and I hope it's working. Let me know. So today's hour is, I'm curious about making hit records. Do you call them that? Hit tracks, hit tunes. I'm also curious about what the producer does. So today I'm having a conversation with superstar producer Stephen Street. He's produced The Smiths, Blur, Baby Shambles, The Pretenders, Shed Seven, Kaiser Chiefs, New Order, The Ordinary Boys, Sway, The Maccabees, The Cortinas. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. The Zootons. It's just, he's basically produced everyone. It's an incredible list of hit songs, hit albums he's had out or he's been involved in. He's also got a new band to talk about, Bradford, which is actually an old band that have reformed and put him in the lineup. Anyway, let's meet him. Here's Stephen Street. Hello, Stephen. How are you? Long time.
Yes, Tim. Hello to you too, mate. And yeah, it has been a long time. I think it was Glastonbury that we were last together a few years back now.
Was it raining or sunny? Because I can never remember which ones.
I think it was raining as per usual.
Do you know what? I've got to say, I'm on my own on this, but I prefer the rainy ones, because when I've been at the ones where it's so sunny, and I go every year, but the ones where it's just the sun just doesn't, there's nowhere to escape it. You're just in it. It's like being in the desert or something. You just can't.
The mud gets to me. I think it might be, I don't know. It could just be an age thing, but once it gets too muddy, I'm like, I'm out of here.
Yeah. You're in a band. You got yourself back into a band later on in your age. We'll talk about that in a minute. But first of all, how's the pandemic affecting you as a music producer?
It's pretty tough. Obviously, being a record producer, you're often in quite tight spaces, working in a studio with the band. You know, you're kind of right up in each other's faces and doing things. And so obviously, we're not allowed to do that at the moment. I'm working remotely. I'm doing mixes for people and, you know, swapping files and stuff. But it's not quite the same as getting yourself right in there and amongst the act, as it were, and working with them and helping to shape a record. So I'm looking forward to these kind of COVID days to be over. I really am.
I think that's a great place to jump into this conversation, is you're talking about producing the band and the actual role of the producer. I remember, I think I've told you this once before, I remember asking Noel Gallagher once, what does a producer do? And he says, oh, they just sit in the studio, push some buttons and then take credit for the record.
But he would say that, wouldn't he?
He did start laughing.
I think he's joking.
He was only messing about, but I just thought it was quite a funny answer at the time. That was when I was on XFM all those years ago. But you always hear about the producer, and whenever you get the PR, the publicity through, it's like, you know, it's got Stephen Street or William Orbit or someone on it. It's part and parcel of the track which you get delivered with the PR, isn't it?
But yeah, I mean, the thing is, the nearest kind of an analogy I can make, I guess, in describing what the role is the film director. Okay, that's why a film director is always mentioned when it's a Scorsese film or whatever, because the producer of a film gets all the money in and gets all the team together, but it's the person that's directing the film that gets the credit, because it's he or she that is creating the film in their, you know, image, as it were, their idea. And also they're the ones that are working right alongside the actors and also alongside the cameramen to get everything just right. And that's really the equivalent of that in the music business, is the record producer, because I'm working alongside the musicians and I'm guiding them through the whole process. And I'll either be engineering it myself or I might have an engineer working with me. And I'm kind of, it's that thing of getting, you know, directing them to get the sound and the performance, which is really important, like getting a good performance out of an actor. It's the same thing getting a good performance out of a musician or a singer in a band. It's a very important stage of the recording. So that's why there's so much importance put on it.
Right. So how do you go? Well, let's start at the beginning then. You started working with the Smiths. Doesn't get bigger than that, does it?
No, I mean, like everybody really in the music industry, you need a lucky break along the way. And I certainly got one. I started at Island Records. I was an in-house engineer at Island. Managed to get through the ranks pretty quickly and became one of the in-house engineers working at the Fallout Shelter, which was the basement studio below Island Records. And although that studio was mostly geared towards recording the artists that were on Island, at the weekend, sometimes there'd other outside clients come in. And that's what happened to me. I was working at Island, and the studio manager said to me, there's a session coming in at the weekend. Can you do it? And I said, yeah, who is it? And he said, oh, it's Rough Trade. I've booked in a band called the Smiths. Now, funny enough, I'd just seen them play This Charming Man on Top of the Pops a week or two earlier. So I was like, absolutely. So I just went out of my way to be as on the ball as I could possibly be while I did that session. They came in with John Porter, who was producing them. And so the very first session I did with them was recording Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now.
Wow.
And that was the start of, it's funny because they took my name and number after the session. So I thought, oh, great, I made a good impression here, you know. And then they did the next single, which was William, It Was Really Nothing. But they didn't come back to my studio where I was working, or they didn't use me. So I thought, okay, well, that ship has sailed, you know. But fortunately enough, a few months later, Jeff Travis phoned me and said the band want to do their next album, which was Meet Us Murder, and they want to produce it themselves, but work with an engineer that they like and trust. Would you be up for it? So that was it. And that was the start of a very long working relationship.
And then when you take that role, how much do you get involved in actually writing the music with the band?
Not so much writing. I mean, then I was really focusing more on just making sure I was doing my job as a good recording engineer. Back then, Tim, if you can remember, there were a lot of really good producer engineers like Martin Hannett, Martin Russian, Steve Lillywhite. They were working with all the post-punk bands, you know, in the early 80s. And technology was really coming on leaps and bounds in the 80s. There were lots of new drum machines, digital reverbs and so on. So a lot of people were approaching record production from the engineering side. So for quite a long time, I kind of didn't really focus on the musical side of things so much. I just really focused more on the, the more kind of audio side of everything, you know, and the quality of the sound and so on and so forth. But, you know, I was learning then. I was still very young. And if I could go back and change things and what I did then, I would love to be able to do that. But, you know, but I think the records actually, especially the Smiths ones, they have stood up, you know, they stood the test of time pretty well.
Yeah, when you listen to the Smiths, your hairs do stand up, don't they? It kind of, I mean, it was an incredible, bizarre band with, you know, Johnny's amazing guitar, and then there's the most surreal lyrics and voice from Morrissey. You must have thought you were dealing with a little bit of magic every time they went into the studio.
Yeah, I mean, there was no doubt about it. Morrissey has a certain way of writing and singing that was completely different to anything else that was around at the time, and just the quality of the lyric, you know, is always up there somewhere. It's amazing. It's, and Johnny's guitar playing was superb, as we all know. But also, I think people shouldn't forget about how good the rhythm section were too. You know, Mike and Andy were really, really solid. And you know, if you listen back to a lot of really great Smiths records, you know, those bass lines that Andy's playing are pretty damn, you know, impressive. So I would say they'd strengthen every single area. I really would. And that's the mark of a really good band, you know.
They're the only band, they're the only great band which haven't come back, aren't they? Every other great band which split up have come back. It's only the Smiths left, really, who it looks like they're never going to do it either, which is such a shame because they would just sell out anywhere, wouldn't they?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a couple of other bands you could add to that list, like The Jam and The Clash, you know, I think, you know, but I take your point. Yes, it is a shame, but what ruined it for everybody within the band, I think, and you know, for everybody else ultimately, is that there was that terrible court case which really kind of dragged everything, you know, brought out all the dirty laundry, as it were, and dragged it further through the mud. And it just didn't, you know, I think that just created an atmosphere which unfortunately is very hard to come back from. But you know, I really did think they were going to reform. You know, when I did those very early Morrissey solo records that I made, you know, I thought I was just like a stopgap, in and that Johnny would be back in touch and they'll be back together as a band, you know, within 2 or 3 years. Certainly never kind of foretold that, you know, that this was going to happen. So yeah, it's a shame.
So how long is it before your name becomes known then and bands start going, we need to work with him? Is it a pretty quick period of time that happens?
I mean, I think, you know, you've got to work hard at trying to create the chances for yourself. I mean, I had that kind of initial success with the Smiths, and there's a guy called Stephen Tintin Duffy, who I was also making kind of records with in the 80s, completely different from the Smiths, but something still that I felt, you know, had credibility and I wanted to get involved with. So, and in fact, Stephen has proved himself as a great writer over the years. You know, he's a fantastic songwriter. So, you know, but there was a kind of a little bit of a fallow period, I guess. And then, you know, you're kind of hoping that, you know, guitar bands especially go in and out of fashion. And because I'm perceived as being a guitar band producer, obviously my desirability as a producer will go up and down, you know, I guess. But there was a bit of a dry period at the end of the 80s. I actually tried to run my own record label for a while. And this is where Bradford comes in, actually, from back then. I had a label called the Foundation Label, but I was trying to fund everything myself. And it got to the point where, you know, I think we put out 3 albums by 3 different acts and God knows how many singles. And even then it was tough. And that's before streaming, you know, and downloading became a problem. So I had to kind of knock that on the head, unfortunately. But, you know, I was fortunate enough to have another big break in the early 90s. And that was obviously meeting Blur.
Yeah, tell us about that. How did you end up working with them? Again, it must have been another magical experience being in the studio with those guys.
Well, as you kind of alluded to earlier, Tim, I mean, normally I get approached either by the band or the management of the band or the A&R person or the record label that signed them. But in this one case, what happened was I'd seen the video and heard the single She's So High, which was their debut single, and I really liked it. And my manager, Gail Coulson, at that time, she was managing Jesus Jones, who were a fellow kind of band on the Food label, which is what Blur were on. So I said to Gail, look, next time you go and see Balfie at Food, could you mention to them that I'd be interested, you know, to work with them? So it was an approach from the other way around, actually. And initially they said, No, thanks very much. We're going to stick with the production team that had done She's So High. And, you know, I could see why, because it was a good, you know, it was a good sounding record. Anyway, they did try a session for the second single with that same production team, and they weren't quite as happy with it. So they did come back to me and say, look, you know, because they were big Smiths fans, especially Graham, I think. And they said, would like to meet Stephen. So I went and met them. We had a drink in the pub next door to Food Records. And we said, great, let's try a session. So we went in and we recorded There's No Other Way. So that was, again, the start of a really, you know, good kind of long-term relationship.
Well, yeah, all right, let's talk about relationships. How important is that? Because obviously a band must come in with a bit of a vision. And then if you want to steer them in another direction, they've got to trust you, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think I often think of it as being a big brother, not in the 1984 sense, but a big brother in the, like, put your arm around and say, look, I've done this before, I've made that mistake, or, you know, this is the way to go. You're just trying to guide them. And honestly, man management is such a big part of record production. It really is. It's a huge part of it. It isn't just how good you are twiddling the knobs or what a great drum sound you get, you know, because that can be really left, if you want, to the engineers. You know, if you want to become a record producer, you've got to learn really good man management. You've got to keep the ball rolling. You know, you might be there one afternoon and everything's just not quite working, and you've got to know when to chip away at it and when to say, actually, I'm not going to chip away at that anymore. We're going to completely change tack and try something else, you know. And that's what they look to you for. And I like to hold up my hands and say, I've never gone over budget on anything, ever.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always very conscious of the fact that it's the band's or the artist's money that I'm spending. You know, there were a few people that I met over the years who were quite happily hiring a stack of gear that would be sitting there on the sides of the desk for weeks on end and didn't give a damn. It was just the record company you're paying. But it's not the record company. It's the act, because whatever the record company spends is going to be going in the red against the artist. So ultimately, it's the artist that's paying.
Do they often lean on you? I remember having a chat. I love Nicky Wire, and he I remember him saying, I think on XFM or something one day, I interviewed him, Soccer M or something, and he said that the artist, he said, too many people are too good at playing their instruments and singing. Music's not about that. Music's about ideas. And it kind of, I really resonated with me, because I thought, yeah, you know, some of the great bands that I love, they, when they picked up instruments, they couldn't even play them. They had an idea of, let's be in a band. And then, yeah. And then later on, they learn on the job. But do some of the bands look at you to come up with the ideas?
Sometimes. I mean, but it's that old adage, if it ain't broken, don't try and fix it. You know, sometimes someone will come in with something, and they've been playing it live for the last 9 months or 12 months. It's the thing that got them signed, because they were creating such a buzz. Why would you want to go in and suddenly change everything? And that used to happen sometimes. You know, someone would be really, really hot, and they get signed and put in with this producer that was a big name, but was completely wrong for them. You know what I mean? And change everything about them. You know, get rid of the drummer and get a session drummer in, or just use a drum machine. And I often used to think, why are you doing that? You know, so yes, you should have ideas when they're needed. But don't thrust your ideas upon people and try and say to them straight away, this is exactly my vision, this is the way it should be. And again, this is the man management side. It's knowing when to step forward and knowing when to step back and let the ideas naturally flow.
Yeah, going back to relationships, you must have had to do some counselling and therapy as well in your time. Because a lot of, looking through the history of the bands you've worked with some huge characters, haven't you?
Yeah, I have.
Personalities.
Yeah. And I learned a lot from that. I mean, Morrissey is quite a complex character. So that was thrown on me as a very young engineer in my 20s. So I learned a lot dealing with that. And then, you know, you get to meet the likes of, you know, Damon, you know, who's a great front man in Blur, and he's fantastic, but he's very strong-minded, and, you know, and you know, there'll be times when I had to kind of really kind of say, you know, Damon, let someone else in the band get a word in here, because, you know, I'm not saying it's like black and white like that, but there's times when I would just try and create a little bit more space for someone else to get their point over and stuff like that. But I love Damon. I mean, he's the most talented person that I've ever met in my life. I mean, the guy just doesn't stop. It's incredible, you know. Yeah. But, you know, in a band, Blur wouldn't be Blur if it wasn't for the fact that you also had Graham and Dave and Alex getting their tuppence worth in as well, you know. And that's what production and record producers are there for, is to try and make sure that everyone, you know, is getting their most important ideas into the mix.
Damon's kind of like such a big talent, isn't he? Because he just, like, he doesn't have any boundaries. He's like, at one stage he was writing an opera, for God's sake. I mean,
guy doesn't stop. He's a machine.
From indie band to opera, and then, you know, on the way you go via the, you know, Gorillaz and everything else. It's
And ballet kind of in Paris and stuff. I mean, no, the guy's amazing. He is. But, you know, you can imagine that it could be quite overbearing for everybody else within a four-piece band if that person was doing what he's doing all the time. And so this is the great thing for Damon now. He's got to the age and stage of his life where he can do whatever he likes, and he can work with whoever he likes to make that happen, you know, whatever vision he has in his head. But certainly the things that I learned working with difficult front men is definitely, or women, whatever, as well, has definitely helped me along over the years. Because, you know, when I worked with Pete Doherty, like much later on in the 2000s, I think if I hadn't learned all those skills of man management that I had, I don't think I would have got anything out of Baby Shambles or Pete Doherty's solo record. I had to really, really use every single ounce of knowledge that I'd built up over the years to use that to enable those records to happen.
Yeah, when I was researching you, there was a time where you had to sit him down and say, mate, we got to work here or I'm out, because he was something like that, because he gets all over the place, doesn't he, old Pete?
Yeah, I mean, it's the unfortunate kind of thing. I mean, apparently he's in a much better place now, but, you know, it's a well-known fact that, you know, Pete had a very bad drug problem. And, you know, it's funny, everyone thinks, oh, everyone in music takes drugs, but they don't actually, especially when they're in the studio. They're actually really getting to grips with, you know, creating work and getting on with it. And I've got to say, Pete really was really the kind of, unfortunately, you know, he was kind of addled by it, you know, and it was a real problem. And it was kind of, it wasn't working for him. I think a lot of young people, when they first perhaps dabble with it, they think it kind of liberates them and it kind of opens up new boundaries and they can be really creative. But after a while, it doesn't. It actually holds them back. And so, And Pete really, I guess, is the only junkie that I've ever really worked with, which is a horrible kind of word to use, but he was, you know. And so it was incredibly tiring and testing. And it was just awful just to see, because those kind of people then get surrounded by some pretty vampirish characters, you know.
So is it rewarding that you got a good album out of, or a couple of good albums out of him? How many, yeah, how many albums did you do with him in the
end? Actually, I've done two with Baby Shambles and one solo record. Yeah. And I'm very proud of them because I know how hard I had to really work on getting those to happen. But the main reason why I wanted them to happen is because I was really caring about the other people in the band as well, you know, particularly Joe, you know, the bass player, is a wonderful musician, and Adam, the drummer. You know, I just didn't want them to be let down. I said I'd make the record, and I wanted to see it through to the end. And it was testing, but, you know, I had to get it done.
Does sound great though, and it's quite edgy albums, aren't they, both of them? The Baby Shamble ones. I was speaking to Alan McGee on this podcast the other day, and he was saying actually a lot of the best stuff he's had on his books, you know, as a label and management, is when the band's been a bit spiky with each other, when there has been a bit of conflict, like Oasis or the Mondays or whatever he looks after now and everything. He goes, when the band are at each other a bit, it can create that magic that ends up on a record. And so I suppose it's not all bad, is it? When, because a lot of the bands you work with, they, there's a lot of big personalities and all, you know, the Smiths, Blur, everything, you know.
Yeah. A little bit of a background friction, I would say, could help sometimes. It kind of keeps everyone on their toes. Yeah, absolutely. But again, though, as a record producer, you've got to know when to kind of calm those kind of those hot moments down a little bit, and then sometimes stand back and let the fireworks go off.
Well, when did it get to a time where you realized that you were part of the promo? So putting your name on it was attractive to DJs like me who are, you know, who are on XFM or whatever.
I never really gave it much thought, to be honest with you, Tim, because the main thing I want to, the only thing I really felt was I wanted my name to be known enough, though, so that in the A&R circles or the musicians in bands, the ones like I was when I was a kid, the ones that read the back of every album, you know, I mean, I remember reading, you know, the back of all my Bowie records and Bolan records and thinking, who is this Tony Visconti guy? He's a wizard. You know, how comes he creates so much, you know? That's what I wanted. I wanted my name just to be read on the back of a record sleeve and I hope that people would take notice of that name. As far as fame, you don't really think of it as fame. I don't anyway, because every now and then you'll make a record and you think the world of it and you think it's fantastic and it will come out and absolutely bomb. So you soon get put in your place again. You know what I mean? You can't go around thinking that you're, you know, kind of, you're the best thing since sliced bread, because it doesn't work that way.
And what happens when you're with a band and they decide they're going to go in a different direction and use a different producer? The two aspects of that are, one, you've obviously built up a hell of a relationship with a band. And then the other side of it is, do you worry about what the industry will think that the band have decided to go in another direction?
Well, I've got to say, actually, I've been really damn lucky with, you know, I've had quite a few acts that I've carried on working with over a very long period of time, which is quite rare in this industry, especially now. I mean, you look at records now and there's God knows how many producers on each track, let alone, you know, a whole album. I always remember when we did the fifth Blur album, you know, and I went for a drive with Damon and he told me he wanted to do things a bit differently. They wanted to take a different approach. And I thought, here we go. I'm going to get, you know, the old heave-ho here. But it was like, no, we want to work with you, but we just want to, you know, we want to kind of do things differently. And it was one of the first things I had to do then was go and see Graham and convince him to come in the studio, because things were pretty, pretty fractious then between Graham and the rest of the band. So, and we made this great album, the Blur album, the one with Song 2 and Beetlebum on it. But it was a complete different move away from what we'd done on The Great Escape and Park Life and so on. So I was really chuffed that I'd managed to be part of that transition to a different chapter of Blur. But at the end of that album, I remember going on to see them play. They're playing in Brighton and they were doing the tour for that album. And I was chatting with Damon after the show, and he took me to one side and said, "Stephen, we're thinking of doing the next record with another producer." And they'd already chosen William Orbit. And so, and I went, "Oh, okay, I can understand that," you know, because they'd done that remix album, and William's remix was by far one of the, well, one of the better tracks on that record. So I thought, okay, well, you know, I was really gutted, absolutely, you know, kind of, you know, brokenhearted. But at the same time, I thought, well, you know, Stephen, you've had a bloody good innings. You made five albums with these guys, you know. So it's time to move on and, you know, let them go on, you know. But you do feel like it's your girlfriend that's left you, you know what I mean? It's pretty tough.
Yeah, I can imagine. Oh, God, it's like when you're trying to move your hairdresser, isn't it? I mean, I don't have any hair anymore, but years ago, you're suddenly going down somewhere, another salon, and then you bump into your old hairdresser, and they're like, "Who's cutting your hair?" And you're like, my girlfriend did it.
Still my own at the moment.
So. Oh, what is it, right? What is it like when you produce a song like Song 2? Let's say that one, because it became, I mean, it still is so huge. What a song. I mean, what is it like?
Well, there's those magic afternoons sometimes when you're in the studio and for whatever reason, everything just seems to click into place. Song 2 was, I mean, I know you're very familiar with all the Blur back catalogue, but you know on every Blur album, there's always going to be one or two noisy, punky, kind of really fast, up-tempo type songs. You know, amongst the other kind of tracks, there's always, yeah. And Song 2 was one of those kind of punky, fast, it's just go for it type tracks. Now, what happened was on that record, the Blur album, the fifth one, I bought myself this new bit of kit, which was like this hard drive recording system. This is kind of before all the kind of computer recording that everyone does now with Pro Tools and Logic and stuff. And basically what this system enabled me to do was to record something and I could mark in and mark out and just hit repeat and it would loop around, round, round, and round. Whereas before I had to record something, sample it, sequence it. This just enabled me to do a loop very quickly. And we made up this little drum loop, which is the drum loop that you hear that goes through the verses and is on the intro song too. And basically there was two drum kits in that room and Dave and Graham were kind of playing this rhythm and I recorded a little bit of it, but just using the room mics, none of the close mics. Loop that and said, okay, that's going to be, we wanted like a lo-fi drum sound loop just to kind of go underneath the song. And they went in and just lashed into that song. And because it was just a kind of, I think when Damon first wrote it, he wrote it very slow and he whistled. But when it was kind of like playing it, the band were really going for it. The only thing that would really cut through was like, woo-hoo! So he started doing that. And it was just a guide thing, really. But everyone went, this is really like a universal call to arms. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. And it just stuck. And Damon tried to go away and write more sensical lyrics. You know, we went to Iceland to do the vocals for most of that album. But in the end, there was something about the vocal take that was done live with a handheld mic in the control room that was so special. We kept quite a lot of it. So that song just seemed to kind of, it came together one afternoon really quickly. Once we had that little drum loop and they played on top of it, it was like, as you know, it's less than 2 minutes, I think. You know, it's just like, first course, that's enough.
But it just seems to break through loads of different genres. That everyone seems to love the song, and it used to be on video games and everything. It was an incredible sound which came out. It's great when you get a bit of magic like that, and something very different. How has the streaming world changed your job? Because I had Mark Ronson on, I think it was Sunday Brunch, and I was discussing with him, and he was saying he's got to try and change stuff a bit. He's aware that you've got to try and get this, you've got to hit the song early, and you've got to try and, you know, you can't do this, like, you know, long, slow build up into a song. He didn't feel at the time, he felt like he was trying to rewrite things. Do you feel that? Do you feel it's changed slightly because of streaming?
I think you can either take notice of that and trying to get fit into the algorithm, you know, the Spotify algorithm where they kind of get to the chorus quickly, or you just got to carry on doing your own sweet thing, which is my theory on it, to be honest with you. Yes, streaming is a problem, but it's not so much about, for me, it's not so much of a problem about the fitting into the algorithm and getting the chorus quickly. For me, it's mostly about what people are getting paid. And as you know, it's been in the press quite a lot recently. Musicians and thereby people like me, record producers, who get a royalty that's pro rata what the musician gets, we're just not earning enough. just not earning enough. I mean, it's better than it was, say, like, you know, at the turn of the century, at the early 2000s, where, you know, a lot of the kids were just going to things like LimeWire and swapping files and downloading tracks. That was really bad. You know, that was because no money was coming in at all. At least something's coming in now, especially for the labels. So it does mean that they've got a bit of money that they can use to spend on, you know, developing new artists. But we've got to look at the revenue that is actually getting paid per stream to the artists and change things, because it's not covering. Well, I've been saying this for years, as I say, since the early 2000s, and no one took any notice, really, because the bands were making money from all the touring and the festivals. You know, festivals are a very cheap way of touring, because you turn up with your minimal backline, put it on stage, play to thousands of people. And that's why festivals are so much more popular now than they were 20 years ago. You know, taking your own system around a tour of the UK and putting it up in different venues every night, that costs money. So, you know, but bands could do that because record companies would give them tour support, and on the back side of it, they would sell CDs and albums. So it made it pay. Then we had the big downloading problem. So bands just had to make money out of touring. And that's why there are so many festivals. And now suddenly they realize that when the touring is cut off, wait a minute, I'm not getting paid much for the music that I've been making. The recorded side of what I create. And I've been saying that for years, because I only ever earn on recorded output. So it's like, well, hold on a minute, something's got to change. And this is what's got to change. But who knows, you know, for that to happen, we've got to get the labels to kind of give up a little bit more of their share. You know, I mean, they're all shareholders now in Spotify and so on. And for a label, if you're Universal, you're Sony or Warner's, you've always got one of your things getting played somewhere, is getting streamed. So you're always earning. But when you're an individual act and you're only getting X amount of streams, you know, per day or whatever, it's very hard to make any money out of it.
Does that mean the labels and the bands are thinking, okay, because are they thinking, let's put all our effort into live then, and studio, give or take it a bit? But I mean, I suppose it's the best promo in the world, isn't it, to get a good record out?
Yeah, of course it is. It's a hit record.
Yeah.
I mean, the Kaiser Chiefs went straight, you know, up the bill at all the festivals and things, because they had a hit record with their first single, I Predict a Riot. If I hadn't given them that, if I hadn't got mainstream, make that first record with them and give them a really big hit and follow it up with a video, I Love You Less and Less and Oh My God, they never would have got to the heights that they got to with on the live circuit. I mean, they are great live. They're a really good live band, but they got there and got people wanting to listen to them because of the hit record in the first place.
How did you meet them? What was it? Them come to you? You went to them?
They came to me. It was funny. I don't even remember a band called The Ordinary Boys. So I produced them. And the Kaiser Chiefs were supporting The Ordinary Boys on the tour. I'd gone to a show. I actually had missed the Kaiser Chiefs because I got there too late to see the support act. But I was talking with The Ordinary Boys after the show. And Nick, the drummer, came up to me and thrust this CD in my hand and said, I'm Nick from the Kaiser Chiefs. We really would like to work with you. Would you have a listen? So I took away the CD. And next day, actually, Mark, the head A&R at Be Unique, which was a label that The Ordinary Boys were on, phoned me and said, Stephen, we're thinking of signing the Kaiser Chiefs. Could you go in and do a session with them? Just want to see what comes out. So I went in and we did a session. We did the I Predict a Riot as a test session. I gave the track to Be Unique at the end of the week. And they were like, yeah, we'll sign this. And that was it.
Running with Jake, the podcast.
So let me get this straight. We are on the Lovejoy Hour to tell people about our show, our podcast.
That's exactly what's going on, yes.
This is great. I can't think of anybody else's show I would rather be on talking about our show. We've got less than 60 seconds. We need to crack on.
Let's not tell everybody about how great Tim Lovejoy is, because people know that already, right? Because they're listening. You got to tell them about our podcast.
So if you fancy listening to something a little bit different, we are Running with Jake, the podcast. Yes, we are a show about running and fitness and mental wellness, but we do like to have a bit of fun as well. We like to have a bit of a laugh. We keep things very real. I think that's pretty fair to say.
We do keep it real. And sometimes, just sometimes, I think we share too much.
You definitely overshare.
So, it's Running with Jake, the podcast. That's our show. And that's our time up.
Give it a listen. You never know, you might just like it.
What is happening with bands at the moment? It seems a really bad time to be in a band. I mean, we're going to talk about your band in a minute, but it's all dance tracks, urban tracks, producer tracks, solo artists. Doesn't seem that there's a lot of room out there for bands.
There are a lot of good bands out there, though, Tim. That's the thing. There are, and but the thing is like before, say like 20 years ago or so, if you were a good band and you were making an impression, obviously you do your early shows and hopefully an A&R scout will see you, and then hopefully a journalist would write about you and write about you in Melody Maker and the Enemy and so on. And there used to be this kind of filter process. So basically, sooner or later, you get a bit of a buzz building up about this band. And before they've even put out their first record, there's the press talking about them, and perhaps they've had their demo played on Gary Crowley's demo show or whatever. You know what I mean? You get a bit of a buzz going, and there'll be a bit of a whittling away of all the lesser things, so that when that band kind of gets to the point it's going to get signed, there's something good there. There's been a bit of quality control involved. Now you can have anybody on their garage band on their computer banging together a track in their bedroom and saying, "I'm a recording artist." And so it's like finding a needle in the haystack now. And there's no good journalists to write about them. I mean, there are good journalists out there, but they haven't got jobs anymore. And you've got all these kind of bloggers instead writing blogs because, so again, you've got the quality of the writing's gone down. I mean, if you look at the quality of the writing in the NME back in the 70s and 80s, it's up here somewhere. Compare that to the blogs that you see on the internet now. It's like chalk and cheese.
Where's the marketplace for the bands? Because, you know, there's so few music shows on TV. By the way, I don't get involved in the music on Sunday Brunch, even though a lot of good artists come on there. But apart from our show, there's Jules Holland and then...
Yeah, there's not enough, is there?
And when a you bit on Graham Norton, but Graham Norton gets just huge, like Kylie Minogue's and stuff. Yeah. So, I mean, where do you get to see the bands? I suppose that's the problem.
It is a problem, Tim. It is a problem. It's a problem indeed. And this is you know, I mean, as you know, this country is fantastic at punching above its weight when it comes to creating artists that can sell across the world. I mean, another band that I work with that everyone tends to kind of slightly forget about, but the band called the Cranberries, that, you know, I mean, globally, they've sold more than any of my other acts and because they worked bloody hard and they toured. But the reason why they took off initially was because the single for Linger was getting heavy rotation on MTV in America on a show that was called Alternative Nation that was only on Sunday nights, I think. It might have been repeated once during the week as well, but mainly I think it was on Sunday nights. And it was a music channel, MTV, but it was a music program on that channel that kind of specialized in playing indie stuff. So kids that were into REM or, I don't know, yeah, any indie act that you wanted to mention at the time, you know, Jane's Addiction or whatever, could tune in and watch that program. And if you got on there, it was a buzz. MTV now is all about kind of wannabe, you know, what's the term they use for them? You know, the false celebrities.
Reality TV stuff.
Reality TV, that's it. So I had a bit of a mind warp there.
That's right.
MTV now is all about reality TV. It's not music anymore. No, it's not about finding new talent and giving it a break on TV. And you're completely right. We've got no outlet for it anymore. And it's a real shame. It really is.
Yeah, there is nothing on. There's no way to find music these days unless you're surfing around YouTube and stuff. So,
yeah, and so everyone. But again, it's the needle in the haystack thing. Anyone can make a video. Anyone can put it on YouTube. Mm. And how do you? There's no kind of filter being applied. No one actually kind of putting it through a process where we get a bit of quality control.
What a lot of the dance world does and the urban acts, which I think is really clever, is they all feature on each other's music constantly. So if you've got a hit record, then you feature somebody else so you can spin it off.
Yeah.
And then, but the other people you've got to be careful about is the guys who choose the playlists on the radio stations. They've got a lot of power. Radio One still has a lot of power,
obviously,
so does Capital and all that lot. If they're only featuring dance producers and solo artists and not actually putting bands on, then there's a problem there, because, you know, that's where you need these bands to be heard, isn't it? So we've got to look at those. And I've sat in those meetings, by the way. There is no, like, if anyone thinks there's a method to them, there's just not. There's people sitting there going, I like it, let's put it on. Or, yeah, he's a good guy. Or, oh, yeah, no, he comes from that label, I like the label. There's a lot of that goes on, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure. You scratch my back and I'll scratch yours.
A bit of that. Yeah, I don't think there's any payola stuff going on, but there's a lot of... there's a lot of people going, I remember taking, I won't say what, but I took a couple of tracks in and went, I think we should put this on the XFM playlist. Everyone was like, nah. Then it hit an advert and then bam, it was on within seconds.
Yeah.
It's like, well, hold on a second. And Radio 1 was playing it. Everyone was playing it.
It was like Rag and Bone Man, wasn't it? His first single apparently came out and did nothing. And then it took off in Germany because they were using it on an advert in Germany. And then, of course, it ping ponged back over here. You know, so
there's been a crossover between producers and artists, hasn't there? As in, producers have become artists. This is definitely happening in the dance scene and a lot of the urban scene, and also sort of kind of the up there in the Scandi world. A lot of the guys, you can't work out whether they're in the studio or at the desk mixing the records. I don't really know what they're doing. What is that whole thing happening?
Well, I think it's more that genre, really, the dance genre, where basically you got a guy who's really good at putting a few beats together, you know, getting a killer bass line, and that tends to happen more in that field, I think. You know, my thing personally as producer is, and still is to this day, is I like getting in the studio with a band normally, but it can be a solo artist, and just really creating something fresh and new. You know, there's a clear bit of tape. Well, it used to be tape, now it's hard drive, but you know, there's nothing and there's this bunch of musicians here, and we're going to create something that's going to go onto that, and once we've got that and we mix it, it's going to be a record and it's going to exist. And that's what I love about it, because I mean, God forbid, if I went out and got knocked over by a bus tomorrow, I could still say, you know, at least I created those things, they still exist, they're not going to be taken away. Those records that I've made in the past have always going to be there. And so I'm actually quite, you know, I mean, I again with this COVID thing and everything, I'm actually really worried about the younger people. I mean, you know, I'm 60 now, so I'm at the tail end of my career in a way, so I'm not so worried about filling every single day of the week with work. But if I was a young recording engineer like I used to be back in the day, I'd be really, really kind of worried about surviving at the moment, you know.
Tell you something else. I was talking about the engineers and stuff, but the producers, the superstar producers. But the other thing which is happening, which I've noticed a lot, is, and because I speak to artists who come on Sunday Brunch, is that the album doesn't seem to be as an attractive proposition for a lot of artists. They just want to do single after single. And I understand that, because that's how people are consuming the music. A lot of people, like my daughters, they're 18, as you know, and they are just listen to one single after another. And it is quite an eclectic mix of The Who, Kate Bush, something, you know, I don't know, Ed Sheeran or whatever. It's like this constant thing, but they don't listen to a whole album. They have no idea of album tracks and exactly what they are. Are you noticing that trend, or do you think there's validity in putting an album out?
That is the effect that you get when you get this streaming platform business. And if kids don't actually have a vested interest in what they're buying. I mean, for me, Tim, you know, as you know, growing up as a youngster in the 70s, there were badges of honour, those records. You used to go to school, take them in and show them off to each other.
Yeah.
And then perhaps, you know, you might swap them, but that was your record, and God forbid they scratch it. You know, and you want it, you know, and that was a thing. That was how you showed who you are. You lived your life through those records. And those records, because you've got a vested interest in it, I mean, I can go and pick off my David Bowie records, you know, from my record shelf at the back in next door, and I know exactly where they are. And I know, you know, I can remember the memories I had when I first bought them. Kids who are listening to a track now, DJ blah blah featuring DJ blah blah something else, might really be into it, but are they going to be into it in 20 years' time?
Yeah.
No, they would have forgotten about it. And that is the reason why the acts that you get, that are really big acts at Glastonbury and the big festivals, have to be acts that come from that generation, because they're the ones who've got the hits that people remember.
For me, it was you. For you, it was Bowie. For me, it was Two Tone. I could not get it.
Yeah, I mean, the Two Tone was incredible.
Oh, it's Special Selector. I mean, the beat. Yeah, Madness. Even Bad Manners. Anything to do with Scar, I was mad for. Yeah. You know what I mean? It was like just. And I'm sitting here looking at a picture of the Specials. It's a poster of their album, which I've got up on my wall, and I still love it. I still have ownership of the band. I still love the band, and I still want to have connection with it. So let's talk about your band then. So back in the day, I'm not sure what year it was, you produced a band called put them on your label, Bradford. And then I understand it was slightly unlucky because they were championed by Morrissey and everyone said they were the next big thing, but then the Manchester scene came along. Am I getting it right?
No, that's right. Yeah, what happened, we made this album and I mean, I always think with Bradford, the way Ian writes, it's a kind of, for me personally, when I listen to him, I imagine him being the love child, if there is one, of Morrissey and Elvis Costello. You know what I mean?
Right.
Lyrics are absolutely very, very English, but very well written, very precise. And there was this kind of indie scene at the end of the 80s that were very much inspired by the Smiths, where there was kind of, you know, that kind of thing, you know, some guitar work, a bit like inspired by Johnny and so on. But Bradford weren't just a Smiths copycat band. There was something else to it. They had a bit more of a soulful thing to them as well, to be honest with you. But obviously that was very out of step. What happened was I made the album with them. We put it out independently in this country. We managed to get it licensed to Sire in the States. But we were going through Rough Trade Distribution over here, and Rough Trade Distribution had a really bad year and nearly went under. And so they weren't paying money that they were taking on the records they were distributing to the labels. So I wasn't getting the money back after spending the money on making this record. So it gave us a real hard situation where we couldn't really spend a lot on promoting it. And then also, what happened was, as you mentioned, Manchester happened. So they really were out of sync. You know, they just weren't part of the zeitgeist at that time. And so Sensitive Skinheads singing, you know, songs about Skinstorm and so on just didn't go down well with all the people who just wanted to drop an E and get on it. So, you know, they just basically fell apart. And so I didn't hear about them for many, 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 many years. And then about 3 years ago or so, a small label in Germany called My Turntable Friend, I think it's called, approached the band and asked them if they could get hold of their, you know, all their tapes and see if they could put out a compilation. And that's what happened. And actually, it created a bit of a, you know, they enjoyed doing that. And I managed to dig out all the tapes I had. And it kind of struck me, actually, there was something good there. But I didn't give it any more thought. I was just happy for them. They'd managed to get the track out, the compilation out. But then what happened was that Ian and Ewan had started to kind of reconnect and started writing songs together again. And they sent me a few ideas. Initially approached me to see if I'd mix it. But I kind of went back to them and said, look, it needs more than just mixing. We need to do a bit more work on this. But if you're up for it, why don't I become... because they didn't have any budget to work on anything. I said, why don't we just all work together on this? We'll keep swapping files and we'll work on this and we'll make a new Bradford album. I'll become a member of the band because I wanted to play bass on a few things and so on and so forth. And they were delighted. So we became a trio and we worked on this new album, which we're really happy with. And it's coming out this Friday. Yeah.
How much are you enjoying it?
It's just really nice to play again, you know. I mean, to be honest with you, I did play again when I did Pete Doherty's solo tour back in 2010. I was on stage with Pete over that period of time promoting his solo record. I actually played Glastonbury, playing Time for Heroes at Glastonbury with Pete Doherty was one of the highlights in my life, I tell you.
Amazing.
Yeah, if you look it up on YouTube, you can see it there. He even goes, go on, Streety, when I try and attempt to play the guitar part in it. But that was wild. So, you know, 2010, now I am playing live on stage in Pete's band. So that was quite a buzz. And that kind of, I enjoyed that. It was like a full circle because I started being a musician in the band, you know, when I was a teenager. And I kind of got a deal but didn't get anywhere with it. So I'd been a musician and then gone through to set recording, engineering, producing. And to go back on stage and play live again was quite a buzz.
What sort of band were you in then when you were a kid?
Oh, in fact, we were a slightly ska-type band. We toured with the Beat. The band was called BIM, B-I-M it was called, BIM. And, we didn't really get anywhere, to be honest with you. But, you know, we managed to kind of do a tour, support the Beat, as it were. And but out of that band, actually, came two people, myself and Cameron McVeigh. Cameron McVeigh went on to work with Nina, and in fact, he married Nina Cherry. And he also did the Massive Attack first album. So out of that one little band, two people went off and became producers in their own right and actually did some pretty damn good work, dare I say so myself.
can I be self-indulgent and say, what was it like being on a Beat tour? Were they, was it just
incredible? Well, in fact, the time we were touring, Mirror in the Bathroom was number one.
Wow. So,
I mean, it was at the peak of their powers. It was incredible. Yeah,
because they, again, a band like Horace from The Specials the other day was saying up-tempo music with a serious message. The Beat were very political in their messaging. And that's why I like the two-tone whole movement, because sort of anti-racism, and, you know, and I loved it. But the music was dance music. It was fantastic. And I imagine those...
It was great too. You know, the shark,
Yeah,
it's funny. Well, actually, Cameron, he was also a budding photographer, and he actually took the front cover shot of Badness. You know, the one where they're doing all the walk.
Yeah,
I think Cameron took that photo. Yeah.
Oh, that's incredible. Right. So you're in the band now, Bradford. So what's going to happen with you say that the album's out. Are you going to be able to tour it eventually when we open up?
I don't know. I mean, the thing is that this current climate, obviously, we can't do much touring at all. Also, we've all got our own day jobs. I mean, Ian and Ewan have got their jobs. And obviously, I got my job as a record producer. I think what happened was when they brought out the compilation a few years back, Ian and Ewan did do a few. They did get a drummer and a bass player in and try to do a few dates, and they found it was a real schlep, to be honest with you. Wow. You know, it's hard work going out there touring. We're too old to go in the back of the transit van up and down the motorway. I've got no interest in doing that. You know, perhaps if there's a few interesting things that get offered our way, we might try and put together perhaps an acoustic kind of way of doing it or, you know, something. But to be honest with you, I think it's possible in this day and age, if you want to be an act that just focuses more on just recording rather than being, you know, a touring group. And so for the time being, that's what we're focusing on. And if you get a good reaction to this record, you know, and you know, it's positive enough, we will do another one. We'll follow up with another one in time.
Perfect. All right. What advice would you give to, let's start with bands or artists at the moment, if they're trying to make it, as a producer and engineer, anything, what are you looking for when a band walks into a studio? What are the tips you can give bands for making a success?
You've got to be able to have real faith in what you're doing. There's got to be a chemistry though. I always said this, you know, as soon as I met the Smiths and I was in the room with those four people, I thought there's a real chemistry here between them. I had the same thing when I met Blur. I had the same thing when I met the Cranberries. You know, there's something special there. There's something that you can't fake it. It's either there or it isn't, you know, it really is quite an important element. There's got to be that bit of magic there. I think also the thing is that as a musician, don't ever think that, and this actually comes as a theory of life. You know, I know you're going to ask me a question about, you know, meaning of life and all that, but I always say you never stop learning. You never stop learning. Doesn't matter doesn't matter how many number ones you've got. There's always a new way to try and do something, you know? And so never close your mind off to trying a new way of doing something.
Well, I was gonna ask you what's one piece. Like I ask all my guests, what's one piece of advice that's been invaluable to your life? Is that it, or have you got something else?
Well, I think the other thing, the way I look at it, I mentioned earlier, but I say I've been lucky to kind of have certain breaks. But there is a certain kind of adage: the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Yeah,
you know. And you know, because you know that, you know, we're all kind of fighting for our own little space, aren't we, in the jobs that we have, you know? And you know that if you sit back and just wait for things to happen, they could happen. But we all know that if you just work a little bit hard and chip away at a few things and put a little bit of extra effort in, you might be luckier and get the new jobs or the new contacts that you want. So that is something certainly that I feel that you've got to do, especially when you're younger and you've got the energy to do it, you know?
It's funny. While I was interviewing a someone recently, and they were talking about how often they worked hungover, and I thought, I have never worked hungover because I love my job and I couldn't do live TV hungover. I mean, I know I look hungover a lot of the time. That's just because I'm old and ugly. But the idea, and I remember interviewing Vidal Sassoon. I said to him, and I love Vidal. He's just a really clever guy. And I said to him, what was the 60s like? What was their hedonism like? It must have been amazing. He goes, oh, it probably was, but I was never there. I went home and went to bed. He said, I wanted world domination. And so I had to go and work hard and went he just said all the people who partied really hard are either dead or have no money. All of us who went home, we were the ones who made it.
It's exactly my same principle when I was working with all the bands that I've worked with over the years. You know, I wasn't into doing all-night parties in the studio with a band. You know, I used to say to Blur when I first met them, because I think they thought it was going to be like, going to go in the studio, be in the studio all late, you know, late night and everything. And I was like, well, I've started at 10. It's now about 10 o'clock now. I'm going to go home and you're going to go home. You can see your girlfriends for a couple of hours, have a drink if you go back up to Soho, but I want you back in the studio again tomorrow at 10. We've got a job to do. And that working principle that I've got, that kind of, that's rubbed off on Damon, and that's how he is now. Damon comes in and he gets to work and he leaves at 6 o'clock in the evening. And I've never known anyone who puts out more records than him. It's no point, as Sassoon said, if you do all those late night sessions and party on down, you end up getting burnt out. And you become a victim, and then you become a martyr. No one's going to thank you for working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
Yeah,
I had a life. I had a family. I wanted weekends off so I could watch football or play football, or you know, I wanted to be able to do something that gave me perspective. So when I went back in on a Monday morning, I was fresh and ready to go again.
Very true. Lovely to talk to you. Final question. You've just said I'm going to ask you, so I might as well. What is the meaning of life, Stephen?
As I said, I think it's never too old to learn. Always strive to improve and move ahead. Don't spend too much time looking back, you know. Move ahead.
I really enjoyed our conversation today. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Top mate. Man. Lovely to see you again. Great Cheers. Stuff.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quokka. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.